Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
All right, we're off. Sorry about that bumpy start to the show, guys, but seems like someone has got a bit too big for their britches. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's a phrase.
Anyway, how are you doing?
I'm all right, actually. Yeah, I'm all right. Yeah, how are you?
I'm fine. Welcome to another good. Welcome to another fuck me. Welcome to another fun-sized family. What is it?
Five-star fun-sized family. No, fun-sized. No.
Five-star family fan club.
Yes.
Just I mean, I obviously know how to say all that, guys. But I'm just letting you know at home that when you struggle, you know, it's something that we all have to go through at some point. So just...
when you're trying to tell your friends about fan club and you can't get the phrasing out, you know...
Just remember that...
You're not alone. You know, that's all right.
Just remember, when you care so much about fan club and you're telling your friends about it and you struggle to get the words out, just remember that you're more professional than the people that do it. So I'm sorry to lump you in with that, Nat, but it's true. So it's Friday, it's midday. The weekend starts here, as Pat Sharp used to say, which was true, right? Funhouse was on a Friday, right?
Yeah, and you know what? I think it did feel like the weekend was starting. I think he was. I think he nailed it.
Yeah,
I think he's right. Yeah, I think when Funhouse was on, I did feel a bit like it's the weekend.
Yeah, the opening credits to Funhouse of Pat Sharp hauling himself out of the pub garden. A fag in hand, twins, flanked by the twins either side of them, making his way down to the go-kart emporium and saying, oh, well, I started the weekend at lunch, but let's go. Let's go for it. That was obviously fan-sized. That's fun-sized family, fun-sized five-star Funhouse.
Funhouse, yeah, different show.
What is this today? Let's start properly. Right. Good evening. Today is Friday. I'm doing that thing where I'm sort of slightly distracted in my head, so I'm not listening to the words that are coming out of my mouth because I'm thinking about something else while I'm talking, filling up content.
Gotta live in the moment.
I would hand it over to you, Nat. But I don't think you're quite ready to do what I do yet.
Not quite ready for the big time.
Maybe in another 3 years. it's good. So how have you been this week, Nathaniel?
I've been all right. Yeah, I've been all right. I feel quite busy. Although when I looked at it, I thought I was quite busy all week, but I have seen a lot more films than last week when I was looking at my list. And I was going, oh, well, I found some time to do some background stuff for the show. Of course, I pretend I watch films as research for the show. Yeah. Yeah. So it becomes a thing now that I can justify it with going, well, you need to have something to talk about, don't we? And on fan club. So
I watch YouTube all week and I'm like, yeah, so that I can keep abreast of the the fan of what people are into, you know. What it does is it makes me realise that we are moderate fans.
Yeah,
because people that really, 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 they don't just care about stuff. They care about stuff to the point that they destroy the stuff that they care about.
Yeah, and you know what as well? I think when that seems to happen, I think it basically destroys any interest I have in that thing as well. I think it really erodes. So I'm just like, I'll just watch what I like that's not that. It almost like makes me leave that at the door. Like, do you know what? Have it then. I'll watch something else. Don't like what I like anymore.
Sure, maybe a little bit, but it just makes me feel like I always think that if we like, I don't think fans should be able to say, like, if you watch a soap opera and it's a long-running soap opera and you really like a character, and the character is going to get killed off. And I think if there's an outcry by the fans, say, oh, don't kill them off, you know, I think that maybe the people that are running the show can kind of renegotiate a contract or kind of like go, well, all right, we were thinking about killing off that character, but maybe not. And maybe sometimes if there's a character that you love to hate that's so despicable and then they're going to kill him off and you go, oh, but we really hated that character. So then maybe a season later they bring them back and I think that's all fine. But when people are having an impact on a story that is as yet untold, before they even know whether they'll like it or not, they've got all of this input. And it's kind of like, I can talk about something very specifically that's happened within the last week, if not fortnight. But if we all had like an input into what happened in Back to the Future 2, and we were like, oh no, it's got to be like this. And then, you know, all of those films that people, all of those films that we grew up with that paved the way for perpetual childhoods, where no one ever has to grow up, you know, I'm just thinking about all these 45-year-olds that are kicking off about Masters of the Universe at the moment. And yeah. I'm just thinking, aren't you watching it with your fucking kids?
Yeah.
You should all have, A, better things to be worrying about, and B, kids. And watching TV with, you shouldn't care about Masters of the Universe, but maybe because you loved Masters of the Universe growing up, you should be kind of like introducing it to your children and like going, I grew up with this. And yeah, it's going to be politically or it's going to be different from what it was when you were growing up, but I don't know. Anyway, so I'd like to talk about Masters of the Universe because I think what's happened with that is really interesting.
Okay, well, you'll have to fill me in because I noticed that it was on Netflix and pretty much went, nah. Two, then I noticed people seeing a headline of people saying they're upset about it, but I didn't know why they're upset about it. And then I wasn't bothered to read it. But to me, He-Man's one of those things that if you've ever tried to revisit any of that stuff, it really is two-dimensional, you know. It really is when he's there, it is about a bloke who turns into a strong bloke who looks the same with a tan and about the best.
It's about a strong bloke that turns into another strong bloke. The exact same strong bloke. It's about this big, muscly guy who goes by the power of Grayskull and... what Grayskull seems to do is just change his outfit. It doesn't do. Do you know what I mean? That's what. So I've got a complicated history with Master of the Universe and He-Man. What I'm not into at the moment is properties being taken over by people that don't have maybe necessarily the property's interests at heart. And I think that it's very difficult to talk about, really, I suppose, because it's a fucking minefield if you talk about any of that. But I think that there should be diversity and I think there should be stuff out there for everyone. But I also think that if you are basing something on a fan base, for instance, James Bond, which hasn't been, the latest James Bond hasn't been released yet, and Phoebe Waller-Bridge has kind of written it, and people are all up in arms. You know, I don't give a fuck about James Bond. I've said this numerous times on the show. I don't care about James Bond. But what I would say is, if you've got a franchise that is pushing 60 years old, then to suddenly change what the fan base likes about it, then who are you doing it for? Because the fan base aren't going to suddenly start, if you burn the bridges with your fan base and don't deliver what they're interested in and what they've been coming back all this time for, then why would they come back? And then if you've got a 60-year-old franchise, who are you automatically going to fill the seats with? you know, you've spent 60 years developing the franchise, and now all of a sudden you're saying we're actually going to cater for a completely different audience. Well, why would that audience come and see a franchise that's already established itself 60 years for not being particularly inclusive? I think James Bond has had a history of being racist and misogynistic and sexist and all this other stuff, right? And that's part of why some people go and see it. I don't think it's been... I think Daniel Craig has done a lot with it. I think his films have been slightly more watchable than others. I always really enjoyed growing up watching Roger Moore. I don't really give a fuck about James Bond, but I do sort of like appreciate the fact that there are people that really love it. But also, James Bond as a franchise, because it is so old, does have a history of changing with the times with every kind of installment that they've made. But the stuff, I think there was the identity politics argument that was brought into Star Wars, where people like say, well, now we've got a female lead. And I think the argument was there was always a female lead in Star Wars from the 70s, you know. And I think Star Wars always tried to do, always tried to be as diverse as it could be. When you look at what else was going on in, you know, from 1970s, what else was going on in the culture? It wasn't pushing the boundaries that far, but it was actually kind of like doing something. And I think they made the entire first Star Wars film and realised when they finished it that there weren't any black people in it. And so they were like, well, who can we get to be Darth Vader? Who's the most famous black actor that we can get to do? So they got James Earl Jones. And then in the sequel, they rectified that and they brought Lando in as kind of like this character. Mm. And so I think that when the new Star Wars sequel trilogy came along, they brought in John Boyega and Daisy Ridley, and they were like going, hey, see? And then they Oscar Isaac as well, and with Last Jedi, they were kind of like, Oscar Isaac is a hot-headed fanboy that's told by Laura Dern to sort of like wind his neck in, and John Boyega didn't really have anything to do, so there was a lot of hype about the fact that they had, out of the main three cast members, one of them was black. But then I think John Boyega has gone on record to say that he was really disappointed with the character arc that his character went in, because it was all mainly for show, and Disney didn't really back up that with a decent character or a storyline for that character. And then with Daisy Ridley, she's the lead. I don't think anyone at all had a problem with the fact that there was a female lead. But the press kind of like took that and made it into about identity politics, where in actual fact it was more to do with the fact that they didn't plan a trilogy when they started, and it was a trilogy that is, you know, they were like saying, well, we want to make it more accessible to people, and you go, Star Wars is the most successful franchise, how much more successful do you want it to be? It's kind of absolutely put a female lead in and put a diverse cast of actors in there, and you know, but you've got to have a story you can't just base it all on diversity. You've got to have a story in there that people respond to, and then it gets murky because there are racists out there and there are misogynists out there, and every you know, ironically, everyone gets like forced into, oh, well, you're either with us or against us, and it's kind of, it's more complicated than that, you know. I know I really loved things about The Last Jedi, even though I hated the film in total. I really loved things about The Last Jedi that other people seem to really hate. And my issues with The Last Jedi turned out to be different from what other people thought. But there is a thing at the moment. I know people are really worried about Indiana Jones. They've done stuff with Batman. The other thing with the Batwoman TV series seems to be that they've gone, right, we've got, it's not a Batman TV series, it's Batwoman. Batwoman comes here and she's going to take over the mantle of the Bat. And that's great, but they seem to have just sort of like inserted a woman into Bruce Wayne's costume. And she said, well, I'll make this into it. It's kind of like, what you've done there is you've taken all of something that a male character has achieved, and you've gifted it to a female character, Whereas what would have been better is making that female character build up her own career rather than actually just sort of like take it from another character. Because what's the point in that? That's just lip service in the end. It doesn't actually prove to be, it's not a positive role model.
Well, with Batwoman, I think is a probably different example because that's a character, again, who has been in the comics, I think, since the 40s, I think, and was initially meant to be Bruce Wayne's wife at a time when everything was much more kind of family values-y. But then, but actually, as that kind of series went on, they always thought it was better that Bruce Wayne's more of like a playboy. And so they kind of then put him up with lots of other kind of, he's got loads of girlfriends. So that character's kind of been around.
But specifically with the TV series, she finds Batman's Batcave with all of his gadgets.
Oh, right. Okay. Okay.
And then she inherits Alfred. Right. And then she gets a bat suit and she says, do you know what will make this better when it fits a woman? And you go, sure. But that is all of Bruce Wayne's stuff.
Yeah. I also suspect like, with a series like that, they probably would have gone, can we do a Batman TV series? And they go, no. And someone goes, Batwoman? They go, sure. Do you know what I mean? And they've made it, almost have made it more into a Batman. Like they're using all the Batman supporting cast then to make a Batwoman series.
And I don't think this is really, it's not really about real life diversity. I think it's about, corporate diversity.
Oh, absolutely.
Where they've gone, oh, well, we'll do a Batwoman TV series, but in actual fact, that's a great idea.
Mm.
You know, but why would you set it up that she's basically turned up out of nowhere while Bruce Wayne is away and nicked all of his stuff? how does that make a strong character? It's kind of like it's silly. So there's all this stuff, and so with Masters of the Universe, all of these, Masters of the Universe was it was called He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. And from what there's various reasons, and there's the toys who made us. I think there should be stuff out there for absolutely everyone. I'm just clarifying, right? And there should be stuff that we can all enjoy together, right? And if you're watching something like James Bond and it is not inclusive and it makes people feel like it's not for them, then you should do something about that to kind of like make it into entertainment for everyone, right? But I don't think that you should be introducing characters at the expense of pre-existing characters. You should be I don't think that you find strength in whatever new character you bring by cutting down the strength of a pre-existing character. You don't. My friend Pat always said to me, he drew two lines, our friend Pat, he drew two lines on a piece of paper, right? And he gave me one line and he had the other line. And he said, and they were the same length. And he said, how do you make your line longer than my line? And I said, I don't know. And he said, well, what you can do is you can take my line and you can tear it in half. And I was like, right. He said, or you can just draw your line longer. And I think that the way that you achieve stuff and the way that you kind of like enrich your own life is by not by tearing down other people, but by kind of like trying to make your life as full and interesting as you can. And I think that goes hand in hand with how to develop strong characters. Anyway, so when I grew up watching He-Man Master of the Universe, from what I've... There's a Toys That Made It about it, which is on Netflix, which is quite interesting. But the story I always heard was that they made a bunch of Conan the Barbarian action figures, and then the film turned out to be R-rated, which was like a 15 or an 18 over here. It was really bloody and violent, and there were beheadings and stuff like that. And they were like, oh, well, we can't market these for kids anymore. So... what do we do? And they were just like, well, what we'll do, rather than make them Conan, and if you remember the film Conan, James Earl Jones is in Conan, and he has loads of snakes. Oh. I think he turns into a big boa constrictor at one point, right? And so they went, right, well, we'll take all of these figures that we've made, and then we'll just stick new heads on them, right? And so they didn't have to. That's why all of the He-Man figures have the same body but different colors. So Skeletor is a skeleton with the body of a muscle man, who's a skeleton, but he's muscly, right? He's a muscly skeleton, and he also has like a loincloth, right?
Yeah.
But he's got the exact. If you took his head off, he's got the same. He's got the same exact body as He-Man, right?
Yeah.
So then they were like, "How do we shift all these toys?" Now I think that that's been debunked, that version, and that it was an original toy line. But I deep in my heart, I think that's bullshit. Why would you invent a skeleton bad guy that had the body of Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Yes. I've always heard that to be true, and it. And that, as a urban legend, makes sense that that is what happened. It's certainly about that. I mean, the type. If it's not, it wasn't the Conan thing to begin with. I reckon it was a toy manufacturer who had seen the trailer for Conan and went, "Yeah, let's get hold of that." And then whoever owned Conan said, "You can't have it," and they went, "Right, we'll just do our own one then." Like, I think it's definitely got something to do with Conan and that kind of whole sword and sorcery thing.
Because it is sword and sorcery, but it's also science fiction. So they have laser guns, and it kind of and they have flying cars and stuff like that. And so, like, Mass of the Universe is a really weird property where you just feel like, yeah. It is sort of like got a barbarian in it, but also, I think that if from the ground up, from the starting point, you were coming up with a science fiction kids TV series, you wouldn't start with drawing a barbarian, you know. Which is why Prince Adam has the same body as He-Man in the, you know. And so I just think that it's really suspect to think that, oh, this was all planned. It's kind of like they've been building they built the lore as it went, and they had all of these toys to shift. So they made a Saturday morning TV advert, which was for kids, animated, but it was an advert for the toys. And then they would just, every season, they would add more and more characters, more and more toys on the shelves. I loved those toys. I found, like, the combination of... So He-Man ran between 1983 and 1986. And I used to collect as many as I could. Couldn't ever afford the action sets or anything like that. So my dad actually... made me a Castle Grayskull out of kind of almost like recycling. So the turrets were giant yogurt pots, and there's all this like polystyrene packaging and cardboard tubes and all this other stuff. And then he built it all on this large wooden board, and he covered it in sort of canvas, and he painted it, and it was really robust, and there were like turrets for characters to stand in, and there were like hidey hole, you know. It was better than the actual action set that you got, which was quite flimsy. It was like this huge thing, and I could keep all my characters in there, and it was a playset. It had a portcullis. It was like, yeah, my dad made that. And then I think maybe when Christmas came along, he made a Snake Mountain for me, and I remember the nose for the snake, and again, it was sort of like he used sort of like you know, household rubbish and he made it really robust, and the nose on the snake was one of those ice creams that you got with a bubble gum in the bottom.
I know.
What were they called, the cones ones?
I know exactly.
A plastic cone, a screwball. Was it a screwball?
Yeah.
So there was those, was that, and there were these tubes on them where you put like marbles in and you could attack other players. I had He-Man, my sister had She-Ra, right? Uh-huh. So she collected all the She-Ra stuff and I collected all the He-Man stuff. And then we'd have kind of like, you know, on Saturday mornings, we'd empty all of our toys on the in the living room, and we'd play He-Man and She-Ra, right? I used to like the cartoons a bit. There was always a moral at the end of the cartoons that told you not to like play on train tracks.
Yeah, or run with scissors.
Weird that He-Man knew so much about what kids are up to on planet Earth. And then I didn't really think about it. And then the film came out, and I remember going to see the film that Dolph Lundgren was in, and being really confused by it because it was so far removed from the TV series and the cartoon and the toy line. I couldn't understand why Dolph Lundgren talked like that. And, you know, I just thought like, I found like the whole thing really bizarre and weird. And there's the guy from Back to the Future was in it. And yeah, okay. and so there was all of that. And then I don't think I ever thought about it. It was like one of the, oh yeah. And then in Ghostbusters 2, which came out in 1989. So the cartoon finished in 86. The film came out in 87. And in 89, Ghostbusters 2 came out. And there's a scene at the beginning where the Ghostbusters are at a birthday party. Ray and Winston are at a birthday party and all the kids, they sing the Ghostbusters theme tune, which exists within the world of
Ghostbusters.
And then all the kids shout, He-Man, He-Man. And even as a nine-year-old or even an eight-year-old, whenever Ghostbusters 2 came out, I was there going, He-Man? That is so old news. Why are the kids into He-Man? Has he got, you know? And they tried to relaunch He-Man a few times over the years, like in the late 90s, mid-2000s. And they've been trying to make a film for about 20 years. John Woo was attached. I think McGee was attached. It's this property that's very difficult to deal with.
And they've done relaunches, haven't they? Like those toys have happened every other year. There's a relaunch, trying to relaunch the toys and things again.
I think the thing that's really cool about He-Man is the iconography. And even like the landscapes and those really detailed paintings. Who did the paintings? Is it Frank?
I don't know.
Frank.
Not Frazetta. Like really,
yeah.
Did he do He-Man? He did a lot of the Conan stuff, but I don't know if
he did Conan stuff, and then the Frank. And then I think the artwork for He-Man is based on his artwork.
Oh yeah, I bet it is based on it. Yeah.
And it's beautiful. It's really detailed, and it's great, and it's cool, and it really like sparks off your imagination. But it sparks off your imagination more than perhaps the cartoon series did.
That's always what I believe has happened with it, though. I think it's like we were talking the other week about Richard Donner Superman, in that Richard Donner Superman really establishes what the sort of mythology of Superman is that they never really got to grips with in the comic. And since then, you kind of understand it all. Whereas I think He-Man's a property that if you were going to reboot it now, what you'd want to do first is just establish a proper world for it. There's no real world building. It doesn't really make sense. It's all a bit, it all feels very two-dimensional. Like, he's a goodie, he lives in this place. He's a baddie, he lives in this place. But it doesn't feel like there's any kind of mythology around He-Man that you can buy into.
No, it sounds, and I think that's because they made it up on the spot. They had a bunch of toys, and they were like, how are we going to sell these toys? And they made up the mythology as they went. Mm. And then they were like, well, we've got, this toy stinks, so we'll call him Stinkor. Mm. Yeah, right. And we got moss for this one. We made this one look all furry, so we call him Moss Man. You know, and it was literally just like, what can we do with this fucking, this toy's neck expands, so we'll call him Mechanic, like mechanic, you know. Oh, right. Do you know what I mean? It's just kind of, it's real basic stuff. Hmm. And it's very dismissive to say, oh, it's just a toy line. It's just a toy commercial. That's what the cartoon series was. It was a toy commercial. It worked really well. And do you know what? It was a great jumping off point for kids to play with these toys and to create their own adventures and their own mythology and their own storylines. And I fucking loved He-Man. Barely thought about it in all my years since. Right? And then all of a sudden, this new Masters of the Universe series has come out
on Netflix.
Masters of the Universe. It's not called He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. It's called Masters of the Universe Revelations, and it's got Kevin Smith behind it. And you know, you've got a lot of angry fanboys who are angry about the state of Star Wars, and they're angry about the state of Batman, and they're angry about Indiana Jones and James Bond and all of these franchises, and they've got all their hearts pinned on this Masters of the Universe thing that's coming out. And you know, some spoilers coming out for Masters of the Universe. Maybe it's a good time to go for a song, and then we'll talk about the actual.
Okay,
I'll tell you about the series. So after the song, there'll be spoilers.
Tell me good, I'm bitter, I can't. Don't talk fool to me. Don't shake that finger in my face no more, cause I might bite it off and spit it on the floor. Better get secure, get my life insured, buy a house and car, then run. Then sell my bike, my leather coats, those city auto parts and all my guns.
Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back! We're back! We're back. It's Friday. It's 12:30. We're pre-recording on a Wednesday, obviously, at 3:00 in the afternoon. But yeah, there you go. We're talking about, and by we, I mean I am lecturing Nathaniel about Masters of the Universe.
I'm kind of keen, though, because it wasn't something... Do you know what I mean? It was like I was interested in it, sort of. I went, a new Master Universe. But then also a bit of my brain went, no, don't watch that.
I wasn't remotely interested in it. And I'm not saying I'm better than... I loved it so much as a kid. And those playsets that my dad made me, I absolutely cherish. And I loved the action figures. I loved the iconography. I thought it was great. And as a little kid, I was a kid. I mean, I was happy when I was in London and I was into He-Man. And then as soon as... He-Man finished and moved to St. Albans, and then I was bullied. So maybe if I'd have had... But then I went into real Ghostbusters and...
Yeah, you moved on with whatever was new, I think I did.
And also, sort of like Thundercats came along and sort of learnt from Master of the Universe, where they started with all of this kind of backstory and iconography.
Exactly, which I think and had a much kind of richer backstory, yeah.
And I think sort of I wasn't into Thundercats, but Thundercats was a ripoff. It was kind of like he has a sword, he says a magic word, he turns into a superhero, and the main bad guy is a decrepit mummy, not a skeleton this time. And it's kind of like, yeah, that's what you do. So I think that maybe Thundercats learned a lot from He-Man. But the other thing about He-Man was at the time was they were like, this is an action line for little boys, right? We've got barbarians and laser guns and flying horses and stuff. And for the little girls in the 80s, they had My Little Pony and Barbie and Cindy and boys had Transformers and He-Man. That's how it all got divvied up. But I think even with He-Man, they were like, well, it's a bit boy-centric. So then they created She-Ra, which was He-Man's twin sister, and it was a parallel cartoon series with crossover adventures every so often, and it kind of like it brought girls into it. And I know my sister really liked She-Ra, and I liked She-Ra, and I liked He-Man. My mate was into G.I. Joe or Action Force, it was called, and I hated that. Wasn't into that at all. But I don't really have much nostalgia for He-Man. And when it was like, oh, they're making another He-Man thing, I was interested because it's like, they've been trying to make that. I think even like 2 or 3 years ago, they'd cast a guy as He-Man and they were ready to make a movie and then it fell through.
I remember
the last minute.
That, yeah. And that was going to be like, he was quite, wasn't he like more of a kind of weedy looking guy and they were going to beef him up somehow or something?
I think even he had like dark hair as well. And it was, and right. People were like kicking off about the fact that he had dark hair. Like people kicked off about the fact that Daniel Craig was blonde. So, yeah. You know, and Masters of the Universe fan base is different from the James Bond fan base. It's different from the, and not everyone is the same. And I think you can, you know, if there was a good James Bond film and it was as good as a film, just any good film, I would be all in and I'd be going, I love that, you know. But if it's just another entry in a long ongoing franchise, you know, I mean, I don't want to watch all the Fast and the Furious just to get to Fast 5 because that's meant to be a genuinely good film. I don't even know if I'd start there. But that is one of the things, the fact that 5 films into the franchise, there is a film that's worth watching, is the thing that's making me teeter on, should I bother watching Fast and Furious 1, 2, 3 and 4?
Yeah, I'm like that, with that series. And I think with sequels, they almost have to be, for me, something I invested something in originally. Like, if I saw the first one and loved it, I probably would have seen the second one. And it'd have to, it's almost like that. It's a domino effect for me. The idea that there's now 8 of them, I'm like, I don't care. I saw the first one, didn't like it.
But also, I like GoldenEye, but I thought the rest of the Pierce Brosnan films were rubbish and I didn't really see them at the cinema. And maybe I saw a couple of them at cinema, but then, you know, and I liked Casino Royale, but I thought Quantum of Solace was terrible. And then what was it? Skyfall after that, which again was like, oh, this is good. But I was in there because I liked the song. and I remember the Chris Cornell song from Casino Royale more than the actual film. And then I didn't bother going to see Spectre at the cinema at all. It sort of like passed. I saw posters everywhere, but there was nothing that made me want to. I don't know. I've just got. It's kind of like it has to be. I'm not just going to turn up just because you've done so, you know, done another one.
Yeah.
It's kind of, I still want.
And I think that's the problem with a lot of them is that you just, if I see a James Bond film, I usually go, yeah, it was all right. It was all right. And I try to watch the early sort of 60s ones and I do like that because I like I like those sort of spy films that are those kind of Cold War era, quite silly spy movies.
Yeah, but I prefer, if you're going back that era, I prefer The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and
me too,
and The Invisible Man that had what's his face in it,
David McCallum.
Yeah, and The Prisoner.
No, which, I do. That's much more my bag. All that stuff.
The Prisoner is fucking incredible, and James Bond is sort of like yeah. Fine.
Oh, I think that's adventure. Almost where James Bond makes much more sense in the 60s. You go, sure, it kind of makes sense that this is happening here. Whereas like, the longer they go on, the more you're kind of going, who is this bloke? Why is he there? What's he doing it for?
Why are you making James Bond films still? You know, it's like whenever they were filming on the Thames and the Sun would always write an article about it and you'd kind of like go, isn't this sort of like fairly small scale in a world where True Lies exists?
Yeah.
How are you going to do a James Bond film? How are you going to do a mid-90s James Bond film to, you know, to, what's the word? To compete with Arnold Schwarzenegger. What's the point? And then also when you get later on, it's kind of like, what? You're making James Bond like the Bourne Identity films. Yeah. Okay. Or, you know, Mission Impossible. We watched Mission Impossible the other day, the original Mission Impossible, Brian De Palma. Oh, my God. It's I mean, it's great. Why would you make a James Bond film in a world where there's now Mission Impossible? Mm. It just feels like they've got to do so much heavy lifting to just.
Yeah. And I think basically, there's more to that stuff than James Bond, and including Guy Ritchie's Man from U.N.C.L.E. I enjoyed more
which
than
was great.
I enjoyed more than contemporary James Bond films again, and it's just like, right, someone's come along and done an update of Man from U.N.C.L.E. and that's better than the James Bond films.
Someone's done an update of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and that stars an alleged cannibal. So,
and
still I enjoyed it more. I thought Man from U.N.C.L.E. was really good. Anyway, so in the 80s, they were like, right, okay, we need to do something for the girls as well. So they invented She-Ra. Brilliant. And so Netflix, a couple of years ago, they brought out a She-Ra TV series, right? Now, this is all based on stuff that I've heard before I've watched the series, right? The mm-hmm. new Kevin Smith, Master of the Universe Revelation, right? And so they had a She-Ra series that was kind of like, quite a very stylistic, it looked very sort of, it looked like it was aimed at younger children.
Mm. But I think that actually is the look, isn't it, of what a lot of cartoons look like now. You don't really get that kind of action, kind of comic booky looking action sort of series anymore.
Who did Samurai Jack?
Gendy Tartakovsky.
Yes, so I think he's got a very stylized look, and I think that's sort of what She-Ra was sort of like based around. Mm. So I know I didn't watch the She-Ra thing. I'm not interested in Master of the Universe. I'm 40, right? Mm. But I am interested in sort of like this sort of like fan backlash. And so She-Ra came out fine. And then they're like, we're doing Master of the Universe. Kevin Smith is doing Master of the Universe. And Kevin Smith has sort of like said, it's about, you know, He-Man. And then there was like a leak on a website called, I think, Clownfish TV. And they said about a year ago, we've heard that He-Man basically steps aside and Teela, who is He-Man's friend and sidekick, female from the original TV series. I think she was one of the first five action figures to get released.
Yes.
And if not, she was part of the next five. And she was Man-at-Arms' daughter. She's a big part of the first series. And they said, right, what we have heard is that He-Man isn't in the series so much and that Teela becomes like the main character. And Kevin Smith was like, we could have done with your suggestions while we were writing it. But the whole series is literally about He-Man. And now it's been released. And spoilers, He-Man dies in the first episode. And Teela is angry with him because she didn't know that he was Prince Adam as well. And the whole series is about the adventures of Teela, right? And that's what I had heard, and everyone's kicking off, and everyone's like, oh God, you've done it again. Oh, well, Hollywood, you've made another thing about my childhood, and you've demasculated the main character and all of this. And Kevin Smith was like going, oh, well, fans are just horrible. And then they doctored the Rotten Tomatoes. I think the professional critics gave it sort of like something like 95% on Rotten Tomatoes, whereas the fans had reviewed it at 25%. And then they froze the reviews for the fans, and then it crept up to 28%, 30%, 35%. And so there's been some doctoring with the numbers and stuff like that. Apparently, this is what all of the thing is. And now everyone's angry with Kevin Smith. They all hate Kevin Smith because he lied to the fans and he said that the whole series was about He-Man. And everyone is like in outrage that they've made He-Man really woke and Master of the Universe really woke. And I think they're using the term woke as a negative. And it's just sort of like this really toxic sort of thing where Kevin Smith has sort of lied to all of the fans and said that it's He-Man is back. Yeah. And then all the fans have tuned in to watch it and they've realised that He-Man isn't back, but now it's about Teela. And it's kind of like, I think that the whole thing is such a clusterfuck. I haven't watched it at this point, right? I have watched it since. But while I'm making up my mind about it and I'm reading all this stuff, I'm finding it fascinating because Kevin Smith's entire career is based around his fans, right? It's based around the fact that he doesn't really make films for the cinema anymore. He makes films so that he can take it in person, cinema by cinema around the country, charge $100 per ticket, and then he'll do a Q&A afterwards. So he's like door-to-door sales with his films
now. Yeah.
And so Kevin Smith is all about fan base, and his whole career is based on the fact that he is a fan. He's one of the fans. He's making stuff for the fans. And now he's gone all corporate with Netflix, and he's made Masters of the Universe really woke, and he's killed off He-Man, and everyone's really upset about it. I haven't seen the show yet. This is what I have heard. These aren't my opinions. I'm just reporting, right? And a part of me is just thinking, who's this fucking series for? Right? No one gives a fuck about Masters of the Universe except for 45-year-old men who were 3-year-old to 6-year-old boys who were playing with toys that were marketed at them by a boy TV. It was a boys' cartoon series that was aimed at boys that had a toy line for boys, and we know this because there was a female, there was a girl side project called She-Ra, the Princess of Power, and so there was the girls thing and the boys thing. So they've all grown up. They haven't had a He-Man thing since the 1987 film, which was a pile of shit, right? And these various kind of like reboots that haven't worked out. So people, you've got these 45-year-old, 50-year-old men that have been desperate for He-Man content for the last 35 years. And they finally got it. And He-Man gets killed off in the first episode. It's just like, well, who's tuning in to watch the Teela show based on the fact that they haven't grown up? It's just like this crazy thing where you go, who's the show for? Because you've told everyone that it's a He-Man show and then He-Man's not in it. And now, so the people that have tuned in for He-Man are upset. But then who's your audience?
Yeah.
It's not the Masters of the Universe fans, because you've already done a She-Ra show.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, so I don't understand. Why have you, like, I don't understand, like, the whole thought process. And then I watched it because I knew that we were going to be talking about it. I knew that we were going to be talking today and we got to fill the show somehow. And it's great.
Okay.
I thought it was brilliant. I thought the first episode... I don't think it's perfect. I think that it does actually, I think not having He-Man in it does actually make some of the stories a bit boring. But it's 5 25-minute episodes, right? And it's destroyed Kevin Smith's career on 5 25 episodes, right? And but it's like they sort out the problem where Prince Adam is a skinny little guy, and then when he holds up the sword, he turns into He-Man. So they sort that out. That's great. You've got Mark Hamill in it as Skeletor, which feels like a bit of fan service because he's the Joker, and he's Luke Skywalker. So it's kind of like, okay, but and he sounds like Mark Hamill. He sounds like the Joker. So you're watching it like that, and you're going, okay, but He-Man is in every episode, where there's a flashback every week and Teela remembers her friendship. And it's sort of like about her journey to forgive He-Man and to kind of like go, she was lied to her whole life. And so you kind of like, she's sort of like this samurai that rejects Eternia and goes on an adventure by herself.
Yeah.
Like one of them episodic TV series like Kung Fu or The A-Team. And every week that she goes on, like a new adventure, she has a flashback to He-Man. She remembers a fight with Skeletor. And it's about her journey to sort of like forgive him. And it's kind of like, it's a direct sequel to the 80s cartoon series. It's not a reboot. It's a direct sequel, direct continuation. I think that Orko is a really great character. I haven't watched the fifth episode yet, but I found everything that they did with it was just really interesting. And I think that obviously if this is a success, they could pick another character, another master of the universe, and follow that character for five episodes. I think, I don't think they've done enough with Teela to really make her kind of like a likable character. But I think that everything around her is a likable TV show. And I think it's an interesting TV show. I don't think they destroyed He-Man. And I think that, although the character is dead, they talk about him in every episode. So I think when Kevin Smith said the whole series is literally all about He-Man, you know, yeah, it is, but that's a white lie, isn't it? Because you know you've killed him in the first episode. So you know that he's not in it. So it's not that, do you know what I mean? You're not giving people what they've wanted.
Yeah. And also, I think that's damage control, right, though? Because if someone says, we've heard a rumour, Kevin Smith, that this is what it's about, there must be a bit in your head going, oh, shit, that has leaked. So he has to say something, doesn't he? He can't go, yeah, it is, yeah, yeah. Because it's meant to be a surprise.
I think it is damage control, but it's also, yeah, exactly. It's more like, well, it's like what happened with Terminator Salvation, where the big twist at the end was that... John Connor dies and he gets turned into a Terminator. And then that got released. And they said, no, that's not happening. And then when you watch the film, the whole film is leading up to this twist that doesn't happen because they reshot the end. So that they go, nah, see, it didn't happen. You go, yeah, but the ending that you've got is less interesting than the ending that you had.
Yeah.
And that's because the fans got involved and kicked off and changed the ending. And the film isn't as good because they listened. And this Master of the Universe thing, you kind of like go, I think... There's obviously like a long game at play where the people that are making the TV, like Kevin Smith said, there's no way that Mattel are going to let me kill off He-Man. And that is true. And do you know what I mean? They're going to bring him back. They're going to do something. It's the long game. And people are kicking off halfway through a series because this is the first five episodes and then part two is coming later on. They're going to bring him back. This is
in
just
the 90s, they did a reboot sequel to He-Man. So it's not as if like, so now for this to exist, you've already got to go, well, that one didn't exist. So they can have Kevin Smith's one and they can have a different version of it in 2 years' time, can't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. But also, it's on Netflix. This whole thing is so ignorable. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you can just like go, it didn't happen, if you want.
Yeah.
Or you could go back and you could watch the original cartoons. But good luck with that, because they were designed to sell toys to four-year-olds. The original cartoons, we all love them in our memories, but the original cartoons are shit. They are shit. And what we've got now is we've got something that's really incredible. And rather than be a 45-year-old misogynistic, miserable cunt in your fucking, you know, why don't you watch this stuff with your kids and have a conversation? You know, there are these new characters or there are new takes on these old characters that are really interesting and it's complicated. And it's just kind of like, this is a positive opportunity for people to have conversations with their families rather than, I don't know. I just think the whole thing is, so I think Kevin Smith's been a bit out of order. Yeah. I think the whole concept is maybe a little bit, I think that maybe people would feel differently if they hadn't felt that they'd already done that with James Bond, Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Batman, Terminator, like all of these franchises where they've kind of like been reshuffled.
Yeah.
I think people would feel differently if like, oh, I think there's a little bit of, oh, now He-Man. As opposed to just judging it based on its own
things. And I'm sure but there's a much more creative way to achieve that rather than just go, it's now about her. You know, I'm sure you can absolutely do that if you wanted to.
Do you know what? Essentially, the show is now it's about Teela, right? Essentially, when you boil it right down. But when you actually watch it, it's much more complicated than that. And it's not like He-Man shit and now I'm even better. That is a very complicated story about what is a world without He-Man, you know? And they discuss all of that, and you just go, this is fucking complicated. It's more than a toy line. It's more than an advert. There's actually some drama in there.
I tell you, something I've always amused me about the start of the old He-Man cartoon is that it starts off, and there's Prince Adam talking to camera. So you go, right, who's Prince Adam talking to? And he's like, sung to you, the audience. You go, right. So he goes, oh, I'm Adam, Prince of Eternia. But every time I hold my sword aloft and say, the power of Grayskull, I become He-Man. And then it's like you get the music going. And then he does a thing where he turns into He-Man, still looking at the camera, and punches the screen. And I always like that idea that he just goes up to someone in the street and goes, all right, I'm Adam, Prince Turner. You go, hello, Adam, how you doing? He goes, well, you know, every time I hold my sword aloft, say, by the power of Grayskull, I become He-Man. He goes, oh, yeah, let's do it now. And then he's like, great. And then he just goes, smack. It's like he's punching you. He's punching the viewer.
Yeah, yeah. It's good. I recommend it. I thought it was great. I thought it was really great. I loved it. I didn't love it, but I thought it was great.
It was well done.
I think it's done well. It's interesting. There's a purpose for it to exist now rather than just nostalgia. And I think that I don't know. It's just so complicated. I feel like with every sentence, I'm getting into choppier waters that I don't really.
No, I think there's a space for it, isn't there? I think it's at the end it should boil down to, is it any good or not? Let's do some fan mail.
I think it's all right, but it's a little bit boring in places. But then there you go. All right. Fan mail. Hi, Nick and Nat. How are you doing, boys? I recently watched the new Disney film, Luca, and I loved it. Have you watched it? Many people think it's the first Disney film that portrays the LGBTQ+ couple. I don't know about that. That would make it even cooler, though. What do you think, Holly?
As always with these letters, I haven't seen the film. I've heard this, though. And I think it kind of, from what I've heard, it kind of makes sense. That's what it would be. But I guess it isn't done overtly, so I guess it isn't. It's still not confident enough to do that, from what I've heard. But again, I'm basing it on nothing I haven't heard.
I think they should just do it.
Just do it, then. Just do it.
Because they were like saying LeFou in Beauty and the Beast was the first gay character in any Disney film. And he wasn't, really. They just basically marketed him as gay. And then when you watched it, there's very little evidence in the film that he's gay. Mm. And then there was the... two women kissing at the end of Star Wars, but they did it in a and they removed that shot. It was one shot for maybe a split second on screen, and they removed it when they released it in China. And it's kind of like, I think you should just do it and then see what happens.
Yeah, deal with the consequences. You can't do it and then pretend it hasn't happened.
Because I think if you put in an LGBTQ+ couple in a Disney film, and it was a huge roaring success, then you could say you've done it, and then you can make more. You know, there'll be bigots out there that don't agree with it or don't want that sort of thing. Fine, right? But if you give people the opportunity to watch themselves be represented on screen, or even if it's not direct representation, you know, if you just tell a good story. If you give people that opportunity, they might not disappoint you, you know? And I think Disney should just do it instead of doing what they are doing, which is like going, well, we kind of really want gay people to still come to Disneyland. Mm. So maybe if we kind of cover all of our bases in a kind of, you know... The other thing that, going back to Massive Universe, they were like saying Tila's gay now. And, you know, oh, that's interesting. But they were like saying, well, it's in words only, in name only, because she doesn't actually have like a physical relationship with another woman, even though it's sort of a little bit implied. And you go, fine, okay. There's a bit of a grey area where they're kind of like implying that she's gay without making her gay. Right. And there's no sort of like lesbian kiss or anything like that. It's just kind of fine. But then when you actually watch the film, there's no heterosexual kissing. There's no boyfriends and there's maybe a king and a queen of Eternia who are a couple. But it's not like everyone's walking around going like, this is my female wife and this is my male husband. Do you know what I mean? So it's kind of like What's the rest of the actual product doing?
Yes. You know?
Beauty and the Beast is a love story about a male and a female. And so to put a gay character in there, you maybe need to show that there's another gay character that they're interested in.
Sure. And surely, if anything, it's about a bestiality relationship. So it's actually really pushing some boundaries.
Well, yeah, maybe they had enough on their plate. we're too worried about working out how we're going to get this woman to fuck a bear. we'll say he's gay, and maybe, you know, that's how bigoted people are. That's how bigoted people are. They were so upset with the fact that there was a guy that was implied to be gay that they completely missed out on the fact that there was the main character wanted to fucking bone a lion. But there you go. Half lion, half bear, half boar. Three halves. One half. One love. Hello, Nick and Nat. Hello, Nick and Nat. I'm a listener from Romania. And as a good fan, I'm definitely telling my friends about your great show. You guys are so much fun. Nick, I might be mistaken, but I've noticed that you haven't talked about John Carpenter for a while. I think you've just not known. I've definitely mentioned him last week. Right? What's up? Why? I am a big fan of his. Well, it's the trouble about talking about John Carpenter every week is he rarely brings out new content. You have to really, like, go for it. I talked about him because I talked about...
Lost Themes.
Lost Themes 3. What's up? Why? I'm a big fan. Do you know that he's got a new film out in October? I didn't know.
I didn't know that.
I bet it's going to be a must watch. I bet it's not.
Do you know what? I'm worried. I'm worried. As someone who's now this week completed all the Brian De Palma films, I'm a bit worried about when people do it. And come to Romania. As that. And I'd love to come to Romania. I don't know how they're doing in the charts out there, what the demand would be. Though this week we did find out that in Brazil, and the Apple Podcast comedy charts, we are 169 in Brazil, 121 in Singapore, and 109 in Denmark.
In Denmark.
Yeah.
That's great. Is our guest in the room? One more bit of fan mail real quick. Hello, I'm fairly new listener to your show, but have come to quite enjoy it. Fuck yourself. Sorry to say, but you can go and fuck yourself. I am bored and need a new hobby, and you said you wanted listeners to ask you questions. So if you had to,
and you can't say no,
drink a half a pint of blood, piss or snot, which would you go back? Cheers.
In anticipation,
Declan, your
mum. Oh, I see. I see who you are, Declan.
What does Declan and your mum mean?
I think he's...
Is his name actually your mum?
No, I think he's trying to get a rise, isn't he? He's trying to get a rise out of us.
Well, I mean, it's obvious. I would drink a pint of snot. What about you?
It depends whether it be my own or not, but I reckon probably snot. I imagine I probably drink a pint of snot every week or something, just by... existing.
By that standard, then it would be piss and blood for me. Can I have a tequila sunrise, as I like to call them? My first piss of the day. I piss into a pint glass, let all the blood settle to the bottom, and then I gulp it down in three shots, followed by a snot chaser. Here we go. Right, look, our guest is in the waiting room. Let's play a song and then bring her in.
Yes.
We'll be right back.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back, we're back, we're back. We're back live. We're not live, we're pre-recorded. in the studio, we're not in the studio, I'm in my office. And Nat is in his washroom. And we're joined now by writer, director, musician and performer and now filmmaker, Laura Jean Marsh. Hello, Laura. How are you doing?
Hiya. I'm good, thanks. Yeah, good to see you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming on. We've just worked together. Well, I said we've just worked together. We worked together at the end of last year, didn't we?
We did, yeah.
And I was in your film that you wrote and directed called Giddy Stratospheres, along with you, who was in it.
Yeah.
And we've just been listening to your song, Bruise Violet, Babes in Toyland.
Yeah, that's the one.
It's not your song, it was your choice of song.
I know, I gave you an annoyingly long list. I don't know if you saw it.
We didn't see the list. Natalie pruned it and just picked something she liked.
Sorry, Natalie. On my list, I had Just Like Heaven, The Cure, Caught by the Fuzz of Supergrass, a Bjork song, a Pixies song, Babes in Toyland, which I chose, a Radiohead song, a Yeah 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 song, Cocteau Twins, and a Blur song, because I couldn't decide on one. But I'm glad...
I think that's fine. I think it's a really unfair question is to say, what is your favourite anything? What is your favourite song? I can't work out what my favourite food is or anything. It changes all the time.
Well, it depends on what you're doing as well, I think. But I did make a list for you, but I'm sorry about the list. But I'm glad we're going with
it. Thank you very much.
Babes in Toyland, that tune is really violent and makes me go crazy, so it was a good choice.
Well, Laura, all this ever is, Laura, is an excuse to get us to talk about things. And we often think that by talking about what you like, we can spin off into lots of interesting areas just by finding one thing you like.
Yeah. All right, cool.
That's what the show is, right, Nick? That's our excuse for when we don't get onto talking about the films.
What I would say is that people put a lot less thought into it than what you have done. And then when we say, oh, tell us about your favourite film, they'll say, oh, it's good. And then we'll say, oh. And that's what happens when we end up going back to the format of the show. So it's just
I did have a little panic because I realised I hadn't seen a couple of them for a while and I had to have a brush up. And I even wrote notes for you, like a proper keener, because I couldn't remember certain things. And I thought, oh, shit, I look like a right idiot. But never mind.
No. Well, let's go into it. What do you think, Nat? What should we do?
Yeah, let's go into it now. We're talking about it. Let's talk about some of your favourite films, which you've got a huge list of. Or we've got, but maybe this has been pruned, we've got The Shining.
Yes.
Don't Look Now.
Yes.
Lost Highway.
Yeah.
With Nell and I.
Yeah.
Hereditary.
Yeah.
Morven Calla.
That's the one.
A Room for Romeo Brass.
Yeah.
Best in Show.
Yeah. Is that too many? How many people do people usually give you?
There's no too many.
There's no too many.
I'm so sorry.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. I mean, you're too shy of top 10. That's annoying.
Oh, yeah.
That's the top 8. Who does a top 8?
All right, I might give you a couple more then if you've got time. Let me think about it.
We've got as much as little time as you want, but that's not true. We've got an hour. Well, that's not we've got 49 minutes.
Yeah.
But tell us a little bit about Giddy Stratospheres and how that came about.
Well, I wrote it last year when we first went into lockdown. So I was supposed to be actually filming my first feature film that I wrote and was going to direct was a comedy about two girls that accidentally kill somebody by poisoning them with a birthday cake, and that didn't end up happening because we went into lockdown, and I was released for my work one bit of exercise a day, and I went for a run in the park, and I stuck on a playlist of noughties music from, you know, sort of mid-noughties, and a particular music scene that I was a part of because I was in a band and run a club night and stuff, and just, you know, really blew me away, all these memories, and I decided to write Giddy Stratospheres after kind of getting a bit emotional about that period of time in my life, and strung together the script, and I wanted you to be my brother, and the rest is history, really. And here we are. It's finished and it's being released everywhere, which is mad. I never thought that would happen.
Well, you had a premiere, what, 2 weeks ago, was it?
Yeah, we missed you at that, mate. You missed Richard. Did a little intro. I was going to try and force you to get up on stage with me and everything, but never mind.
Do you know what? I saw, because I was coming back from my holiday on that day, and there was a little moment where I thought, oh, do you know what? I might be able to make this. And then we got stuck in traffic. And I was like, I can't make it. No, absolutely fine.
And you came to the rap party as well, so you saw it then.
I did come to the rap party, but I saw photos of Richard Herring introducing, saying something. He had a microphone in his hand. He was standing on a stage, and I was insanely jealous. And I thought, oh, I would have done as good, if not a better job, than Richard Herring.
Well, maybe you could come to America when it goes to America, and I'll force you to do it then.
It's a bit further than Clapham. Was it Clapham?
Was it Clapham? No, it was Dalston, Rio.
Rio, that's right.
It's quite near where we shot most of those scenes, actually.
But I didn't know that my name was on the poster either. So I saw all these pictures of people outside the cinema having their photo taken outside the poster of the film, and I was like, "Oh, I'm on that!" And I was like, "Oh, that's incredible." What was it like having this? Was your first film, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'd written and directed a few shorts and music videos and things, but yeah, this was my first feature film, so it was quite scary.
What was it like going to like a premiere at an actual cinema, especially after like all of the COVID and lockdown stuff that we've had, where you're not even allowed out, you know, to go to the cinema for the first time to see your own film? Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely shat myself, mate. Like I was shitting myself, and I would love to say I enjoyed it, but I was just I was just shaking the whole time. Felt a little bit better after I did a speech, my speech after Richard introduced me. But watching it on the screen, it was amazing, but it's also quite nerve-wracking because a lot of the bands that are part of the soundtrack were there. Lots of people that, you know, like my mum was there, and obviously she's in the, like, represented in the film. Loads of old friends turned up and bought tickets I hadn't seen since that era. So I felt very, like, you know, everyone was going to be judging me for representing this time. That felt, you know, a lot of people feel like they own that time. So, I was just shitting myself. But afterwards, I just was blown away because I'm sure not everyone liked it, but a lot of people were quite emotional about it and came and gave me lots of love. So, yeah, it was a lot. I was exhausted the next day. I could barely move. But actually, you sent me a really nice message of support, and I felt, you know, support from everyone. But, shat myself, basically.
And because the film's a really lovely film.
Thank you.
I think that when I read the script, I've said this in an interview that I did, but like when I read the script, I sort of knew where the plot was going, and then it surprised me, and it didn't go the way I thought it was going to go. Mm. And that's why I agreed to do it, was because when I read it, I was just like, This is sort of exceeded my expectations, and it has surprised me, and I like that element of it, and so I went to see it. But it's like a really nice mixture of sort of like drama and this comedy, and it's funny and it's sad, and it sort of does a lot of things. So it's quite ambitious for like a first feature. How did it go in the room or like on the night?
What do you mean? Did they
laugh where you were expecting them to laugh?
Absolutely. That was something that was really weird, is that because I see it so much as a drama, and I know that I wrote funny elements in, but I didn't expect everyone to laugh as much as they did. And you did get the biggest laughs, by the way, just so you know. But it was like, of course. Everyone was laughing in the right places. There's lots of people crying at the end. And I wasn't expecting the response, to be honest. I thought people were going to be a little bit more, I don't know. I didn't expect people to react the way they did. But, yeah, there was lots of laughing. It was great to hear. There's nothing nicer than hearing a whole room laughing at jokes you've written.
It was interesting what you were saying about the... you already had a film ready to go before it.
Yeah.
What was that film then, and what... And is that still likely to happen then in the future?
So it was called Dave's Dead, And it was just pure farcical, silly comedy about these two girls who accidentally kill one of their boyfriends with a birthday cake, and they are trying to get rid of the body in a house, and it's just lots of silliness and lots of different people coming in and out. Pizza guy getting locked in a toilet and them accidentally killing him. I've just given the whole storyline away, so I can't do it now. But it just felt a little bit... not saccharine, but I just thought after COVID, everything feels a bit different. I don't think people would find it, you know, I just thought I just ditched it. I was like, this is just, life is different now. Mm. And things that people might...
If it's lightweight, what do you mean?
Yeah, lightweight and just silly. And I wasn't feeling, I was feeling a lot more reflective and a little bit darker. And I wanted to kind of reach into the dark depths of my imagination for creating something a little bit grittier. I think the way I felt after being locked away for a couple of weeks in lockdown, I didn't want to do that movie anymore. Wanted to do this one, so I did.
That's weird. I had sort of like the opposite reactions. I was on halfway through a tour, and my tour was really sort of like my show was really not dark, but it was really honest and truthful and open, and it was about depression and stuff like that. And then as soon as lockdown happened, I was just thinking, I don't want to do that anymore. I want to do something that's really light and frivolous and sort of not disposable, but lightweight. I want to do something that's fun. So, yeah, I guess that we all had different reactions to
Reactions. Yeah. Mm. No, I felt quite the opposite, actually. I wish I felt the way you did. But
I just was like, I don't know. This isn't a comment on your film. This is a comment on my stand-up. And I was just like, I don't think me going on after a global pandemic and talking about my personal depression is the answer for what I think my audience wants. And what I want to do is go back and do another thing. But that's different. What I thought was great about the film, and I was in it, so I'm not going to... But what I thought was great about the film is that I remember that era. I lived in Brighton in 2005, and I remember kind of like being at parties and still being up and at a party while the sun was coming up and the walls were sweaty, and and I've seen lots of films that sort of depict that sort of thing. I thought, and I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass, I thought when I went to the screening, I thought, this really does capture the grubbiness and not wanting to see the dawn yet, and all of those things that come from those parties that I went to. And maybe it's because I was that age when the film is set, but it also really felt like it encaptured that mid-2000s kind of era really well. And because it was a really low budget film,
tiny baby.
So I think you managed to achieve something in your low budget film that large budgets haven't really necessarily conveyed. You know?
Oh, that's nice, mate. Thanks. Well, I mean, I was there and I did a lot of that sort of 3-day bender stuff, and that was very much like the side of this particular music scene that I wanted to sort of put across. A couple of other interviews I've done, people have brought up that they're why didn't I want to sort of do the celebration of this indie music scene and make it like, you know, really light and fun and try and put it but across that way. And I could have done like everyone went to Coco and watched Franz Ferdinand and high-fived and went home. But it wouldn't have been the film that's not the film I wanted to make. I wanted to show the darker side, and I had a few heartbreaks back then, and you know, people pushed it too far, so I thought that, you know, that was my truth and that was what I wanted to put across. And I'm glad that it worked, but I wouldn't have been able to live with myself if I didn't kind of execute those scenes accurately, I think. And the characters are all based on people that I used to know as well. So that was quite fun, kind of getting people in the mindset of those dark sort of corners of the after party.
There's the dark corners of the after party, but there's also the people outstaying their welcome, talking shit way too late and way too long. Josh, what was Josh's role on the production?
So Josh played Jasper, but he also was my assistant director, and he's my best mate as well in real life. So
that,
so
that 5 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, talking shit on drugs. I mean, I've met people like that, exactly. I thought Josh did a really good job in it.
Oh, he nails it. And that's why we kept the bloopers in at the end, because I thought Josh, we could have used a lot more of Josh in the film, but we couldn't really fit it in. Those moments would have been too long, so we did leave them in at the end, because he absolutely nails that, like, narcissistic lead singer of a band that won't shut up and just wants everyone to listen to him and is completely blissfully unaware of everything else going on and had too much gack. Yeah, he nailed it.
To what extent is it autobiographical or not?
Well, I mean, it's tricky. There's quite a lot of it which is very accurate to sort of some heavy moments from my past. Just for sort of, I would say a lot of it. It's tricky. I don't want to kind of throw anyone else under the bus.
Spoil the film.
And I don't want to spoil the film, but yeah, it's one of the reasons this has been quite an exhausting process is because I've actually, a lot of that stuff I've never really come clean about. So it's more nerve-wracking because of that reason. But yeah, it's very much my truth for sure. I mean, there's certain things that I've really exaggerated character-wise, but it's my view of certain moments in my life, and yeah, it's pretty autobiographical, but you know, in a cartoon way.
Right. And you said, like, when we're talking about pivoting from one film that you had written to this one, what was the process of getting this made then? Was it that you just went, well, all this kind of money, was it as simple as that, you were able to roll it over onto this project?
No, not at all. Right. I mean, me and Beth, Bethany was my producer, but she's also plays Bella. So everybody who was in the crew was doing something in the film as well. And Beth's sister's a producer, but Beth had never produced anything before. So when I finished the script, I just said to her, do you fancy helping me trying to get this thing off the ground? Like, I know you've never done it before, but, you know, she's my best mate. And I'm sure Nick will agree, she's a sweetheart. And really,
I just gave the thumbs up, though. We're doing radio, but yeah, she's great.
She's great, and also she's just like no nonsense northerner. Do you know what I mean? So she was just really practical, and we just managed to like, I approached a few people about the budget stuff. Like, do you want to put some money towards this film? This is what it's about. Blah 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 blah. And we kind of made it up as we went along. To be honest, it was a lot of scraping together pennies as we went along. And we didn't, because she loved the script as well, we just felt quite passionate about it, and it just sort of snowballed from there. So I needed to get permission from the Long Blondes, who wrote the song Giddy Stratospheres, who I used to know years ago, but I hadn't spoken to for years, and they gave me their blessing. And so I could use that title. And then after that, it was, you know, approaching other bands as well, because I needed that soundtrack to be really authentic. And I was so, I hate saying blessed. What am I going to say? I was really chuffed that they all let me use.
Blessed
they
all is let better me, than chuffed.
Blessed and chuffed. That loads of bands from the time that would usually charge a lot of money to let people use their tunes, let me use them for a lot less, because they were just supportive of the cause. So it was putting together all those little pieces to make it work and making it up as we went along. I mean, we were constantly, like, at one point I was doing all the contracts, all the accounting, all the law, like, I was a lawyer, I was an accountant, I was doing some shit with numbers and just, you know, making it happen. So no, it wasn't. It was a making up as you go along kind of thing, to be honest.
That was going to be one of my questions, really, just about, because it felt like, if it's a low budget movie, how did you get this soundtrack? But you've kind of answered it already.
Yeah.
It just feels like, well, it seems like it must have cost a fortune. But
no,
I guess...
no. I won't give figures away, but it's, I'm forever grateful to certain bands that would usually not license that those songs for like less than, I'm sure, tens and tens of thousands, or some of them even more. But like, you know, they just, the fact that I think I was there for that era, and because the storyline, they all liked the plot and everything to do with it, and they supported the cause, and they wanted to be, I think, as well, because they all know, like, a lot of those bands all know each other, so I don't think anyone wanted to be the dick.
Right. No. Did you know, because you were in a band, Screaming Ballerinas, so did you know them from that?
Yeah, from that, and also running, and I ran a kind of indie rock club night, so I used to put on those kind of five band bills of bands when they were just starting out. So, you know, a lot of those bands I had on before they got big, so they kind of either remembered me from that, or pretended to, or remembered me from my band. But my band were, I mean, by no means anywhere near as big as those guys, because we did okay in Italy, but nobody would sign us over here, so it was hardly like. We supported some of those bands, but I was a teenager, and, you know, we tried our best, but we couldn't quite get it off the ground.
I'm 42, so I feel like I'm sort of a little bit too old for that. But when I was trying to put it in the context, I was going, was this era of MySpace? Was it very much that time?
Oh, yeah, big time MySpace.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that was MySpace was a real thing.
And it felt like, when I heard it, it's like, oh, well, what is that? What is that music? I was trying to think, like, what... But then it almost starts with The Rap by The Walkmen, which feels like one of those, like, oh, well, that's brilliant. I mean, that really has stood the test of time in a way that I think it's slightly better than it even gets credit for. I think that's an absolute...
I should have put that on my never-ending list of songs, but because it is... I didn't really want to... Because I feel like I've just been talking about the noughties so much recently, I wanted to go a bit more like off-piste. The Rat is amazing, and I think that song for me and a lot of people from that time just completely encapsulates that feeling of like pure euphoria. Those opening guitar chords, and just it's a venomous song, but it fills me personally with just such joy because it's that real like hands in the air. Squished in a crowd watching that band when that song came on was always just like maybe some of the happiest times I've ever had watching that band when they came into town. So we have that as the, I'm sure it doesn't matter if I say this, it's the opening song to the film when Lara and Daniel are running, and it always reminds me of that, like before I wrote this, just running to that song is just the best. So
give us a rundown of some of the bands who are on the soundtrack then, so it gives people an idea of what era specifically we're talking about.
So we've got Franz Ferdinand, we've got The Cribs, we've got Blackwire, we've got Rocks, we've got Art Brut, we've got The Futureheads, we've got La Tigra, we've got The Rapture. I tried to get the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, and I even wrote them a very sloppy letter. And that they never licensed any of their music. So that was the only heartbreak I had.
Did they get back to you? Song.
Yeah, they were really sweet. It's just that they just have this policy. They just don't let anyone use their music for anything. So it's precious to them. But I really did go for the jugular. I tried so hard. It was the scene, Nick, where I won't say what happens in it, but where you swig the bottle at the bar, that heavy scene. I really wanted maps by the AAS for that. And I wrote it to that song, but that was the only heartbreak I had. But the rest of them we managed to get, so that's great.
Do you find that you do that then? Because I find that what I do is I go through Spotify and I put together a playlist. And then I will listen to songs on repeat until I've written that scene, because that song encapsulates the emotion of that scene. And so I'll listen to it over and over, and then I'll sort of like move along.
That's interesting that you do that. Do you find now that when you listen to those songs again, it reminds you of writing that particular scene,
I'm doing something at the moment, and I rewatched, I did a short called Killing Machine, and I wrote all of that. I had the soundtrack. We were really lucky because I don't think, because it was for BBC, so they have all sorts of like licensing departments. And so we got all of the music that I wanted, and we had like Kiss and Alice Cooper and stuff in there.
Awesome.
And it was sort of, and so I was able to get the, it wasn't like independent because it was part of the British Broadcasting Corporation. So I just listened to any song that I wanted, and we basically got it. And,
amazing.
And I watched it again yesterday. I watched it again yesterday, and I was like, I don't remember using any of this. And I must have listened to each of those songs 100 times when I did it.
Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah, I did do the same. Yeah, I actually have to just mention something I forgot to mention, but I did have help with the paperwork for Giddy, for the licensing, from a guy called Phil Canning. And I have to mention him because he managed to help me with the business side of it, getting all that licensing.
Yeah. I imagine you were chuffed to have him, weren't you?
Oh my God, yeah. And he was an indie kid from the scene as well. So he luckily did all that work for free. Usually he works for Universal and would usually charge a lot of money, but he did it for free because he, like, again, supported the cause. That was good. But yeah, I did write all that. I wrote each scene to a specific song. So I really wanted those songs. Like you said, Nick, it's like certain scenes, I needed that. So I was so adamant I needed certain songs for those scenes. And that's the only scene that I couldn't get the tune I wanted. So I'm really mega lucky. I feel like lucky anyway.
And what's next? What was it? Because I was watching it trying to think, is this you making a first feature, as in, I want to direct more films? Or was it, were you thinking of it as a showcase for acting, or both, or?
No, actually, I don't want to say this because it'll probably bite me on the arse, but I'm getting a little sick of acting. So I just sort of, like, I definitely wouldn't act in something that I've written and direct it as well again. I don't think I can, unless it's a little cameo or something, but I absolutely love directing and I love writing. And the next projects I have coming up are a series set in the 90s, which is based around Britpop. And I've written a mockumentary that I keep banging on to Nick about called Venom Falls, which is about a little weird town, which is a bit Twin Peaksy, actually. Yeah, those are my next two projects. And I've been directing music videos a lot recently as well, which is an absolute dream for me. I absolutely love it. So, yeah, directing, writing's definitely the way I want to go.
Well, I think we mentioned Twin Peaks off air. That was one of your choices for TV that often comes up on this show. But it's a show that you've never seen, Nick, right?
I've never seen Twin Peaks. Well, I know of Twin Peaks. Right, so you've got Lost Highway in there as well, right?
Yeah.
I can't get into David Lynch.
You can't get into David Lynch. Fair enough.
I can't do it.
Is it because it's all just a bit too pretentious?
I don't think of it as pretentious. I feel like I'm not intelligent enough to I've watched documentaries on David Lynch. I like him as a person. I watched that documentary that's on Sky Arts at the moment about him. I think he's fascinating. I remember Twin Peaks from the time in the 90s. I like Blue Velvet. Was it Lost Highway that I saw, or was it, what's the other one that he did around the same time?
Mulholland Drive is the one that, the kind of one that everyone is usually people's favourite. But I think just in general, what I love about David Lynch, because I adore him, I think I watch his films and Twin Peaks almost like it's like a dreamlike experience rather than, you know, a sort of solid plot line where you've got to follow, trying to work out what happened or whatever. But I just think, the dark sort of weird little worlds he creates, just for me, it's like the ultimate escapism. Lost Highway, I think, you know, what I love about Lost Highway, we could talk about Twin Peaks, but I could talk about that forever, but I think what I love about Lost Highway is the soundtrack's amazing. It's been put together by Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails. So you've got you've got his tunes, you've got a David Bowie tune in there, you've got loads of... what's he called, Marilyn Manson, like really heavy stuff. And I think for me, like, what I love about David Lynch is like he incorporates music in a way that I find quite inspiring into scenes, and just I like watching shit where I feel like I'm just completely lost in another world. And I think that, you know, if you don't try and work out what's going on, it can just feel like quite a dark dreamlike nightmare. It feels like you're watching a nightmare, and I quite enjoy that.
The thing I like about Dario Argento films is that they're like watching nightmares. And it's interesting because you've got The Shining on your list as well.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to work out which one I've seen. I saw the one with there's rabbits in a kitchen. There's people
Inland Empire.
Inland Empire.
Inland
yeah.
Empire. So I watched Inland Empire.
That's so, the baddest one.
Right, okay. So I'm watching Inland Empire, and what I would say, right, so I've got a very similar feeling about The Shining, but not quite. So my thoughts on David Lynch are, I haven't given up on him. I really like him. Everything. And I will sit down and I will do the homework and I'll watch something like Inland Empire and I will get maybe 20 minutes in, half an hour in, and I'll go, God, I'm with it. I absolutely am keeping up with this film. And then something will happen and I'll be like, what? And
then I'll be like, I get you. Well, I think what you should do, what you should do is you should watch Twin Peaks because it's funny and it's also like more of a traditional it's almost like a sitcom, you know, there's so many silly characters and there are dreamlike moments, really weird dreamlike moments, but it's you are trying to work out who killed Laura Palmer and Carl McLachlan's just pure magic.
I think essentially exactly, I think Laura's right, and what you've done is you've gone in too hard. I think you've gone in with the hard stuff. Before you've actually had the kind of, like, I saw Twin Peaks when it was on, so I was probably about 10 or 11 when I saw it, and then it was still like, it was definitely disturbing and terrifying, but it was also like accessible, and it's and you know, when it starts, it's network TV in America, so it's not it's strange and odd and unsettling, but it can never stray that far away from. Yeah. It's definitely his most accessible thing as well, I think.
Yeah, and it's
and
funny.
It's funny.
Really funny. Like the first scene when he's talking about the fish in the percolator, and he's just saying, there's a fish in the percolator. And it's like, what are you. What? And it's just pure silliness. And you're going to do
like
it.
I call it that. I've literally leant over. I leant over. I didn't even get up. And I've got a David Lynch box set next to me. It's only got three films in it. And I've seen Mulholland Drive and Inland Empire. I've never seen The Elephant Man. But then, so one of your favourite films is The Shining, right?
Now, I'd say my favourite film ever is The Shining, I think.
So I don't hate The Shining. And we did actually, we talked almost an hour about The Shining the other week.
Oh, we don't have to talk about it again, then.
No, we can talk about it. But all I'm saying about Shining is I feel differently about Shining from David Lynch, where David Lynch is, I will keep coming back to David Lynch, and I don't hate David Lynch, and I want to like David Lynch, and I want to understand the films. Whereas The Shining, I will walk away from The Shining, and I will try and it doesn't make sense to me, and I will solve a problem with The Shining in my head, and I'll go back and watch it, and I'll come away from The Shining and I'll be pissed off with it again. I don't love The Shining, but I am obsessed with The Shining.
Well, I watched The Shining talking about watching things when you're too young, like you just said about Twin Peaks when you were 8. I found the video I spent a lot of time on my own when I was a little kid because my brothers were so much older than me. So I went and found a videotape and it said The Shining on it, and I think I was about 8 as well, and I thought, that sounds fun. And I stuck it on, no one babysitting me or whatever, and it absolutely fucked me up. But I was so obsessed with it, even at that age, you know, just everything about it, like the music, you know, that opening shot of the aerial shot of the car just driving, winding down those rocky roads towards the Overlook Hotel. And like, I mean, it's daft. I mean, Jack Nicholson is completely bananas in it, and there's lots of reasons why I can understand why people find it a bit much, but I think it's such a beautifully shot film. I went to see his exhibition and cried because I saw that there was this that they had the maze from the maze scene,
and I walked in
and I just saw it there, and I'd watched the film probably about 1,000 times, and I was just like just a mess. I was crying.
I mean, I've got shiny cushions behind me. I've got the orange carpet, and then I've got the green carpet from whatever room it is, 237. And but what I would say about that is I saw The Shining when I was very young, and I've watched it at least once every 2 years, and sometimes more than once a year.
Yeah.
And to the point that I only realised this year that Jack Nicholson's performance is mental.
Like, it's so silly.
I was so young when I saw it that I was just like, well, that's acting. And then when you get older, you're just like, well, not when you get older, 35 years later, you see it and you're just like, hang on a minute, Jack Nicholson's performance is fucking horrible.
I totally agree. And I don't know if you've watched the making of, but Kubrick is just winding him up the whole time, trying to get him to be that silly and then being horrible.
He made him eat cheese sandwiches because Jack Nicholson hates cheese. Yeah. And he made him eat cheese sandwiches in between cakes. And
he was so horrible to Shelley Duvall to get her to that state. So, you know, I love Kubrick's films, but he is a bit of a bastard. But he also drove the people that wrote the soundtrack mad and everybody mad on that set. Anyway, Jack Nicholson is absolutely mental in it. But I love him so much. I do.
Do you know the story? Do you know the story about the Steadicam operator on The Shining?
No, tell me. I need to know.
Stanley Kubrick had the Steadicam operator, and Stanley Kubrick used to yank his arm when he was operating the camera, and it would really irritate the Steadicam operator. And Stanley Kubrick would kind of like get involved, and he'd like yank the Steadicam operator around. And be like, no, over here, and film that, and whatever. And so the camera guy, he didn't know how to deal with it.
Yeah.
So, but he was a Steadicam operator on Rocky, right? And he said he circulated a rumor on set, which was, I was the Steadicam operator on Rocky, and Sylvester Stallone used to manhandle me while I was filming, so I punched him out.
Oh, amazing.
And it got back to Stanley Kubrick, and so Stanley Kubrick stopped.
Stop doing it. What, that is genius. Yeah. I didn't know that geeky fact. I'm going to store that.
I am obsessed with The Shining. I just don't like it. I've seen it so many times, and every time I sit down to watch it, I'm like, maybe this time. Which is sort of different from David Lynch, do you know what I mean? I think they're both enigmatic films that don't necessarily make sense once you've taken them apart and put them back together again. Like,
I think I kind of find, like, weirdly, I find comfort in dark things, and I think The Shining for me again just feels like the like real escapism. I also love Stephen King's writing. I mean, he didn't even like that film, to be fair, but I do love, like, everything about the Overlook Hotel and just feeling like you're in this world. I like the idea that nobody else is there, it's just them. So I used to watch it all the time when I was little, and I found it really comforting. It's fucking weird. But I can appreciate what you're saying.
I think you're right though, but being locked up in a deserted hotel during a snowstorm sounds like my absolute ideal holiday.
Same. Yeah,
it's like no phone lines,
and nobody trying to, you know, you've got the perfect excuse not to talk to people or go anywhere because you can't.
So, and you can explore. Yeah. It's great. Yeah.
I think it really gets across the boringness of looking after a building, though. And I keep thinking that the scene that I always think of when I think of The Shining is that bit of, what's he called, Scatman Crothers, showing Shelley Duvall where the freezers are.
Yeah,
and I just go, I love that it's like it's going into this detail about how we store this food and all these food stores and things.
All the different, like, boxes of different shit. And he's like, this is this. Yeah. I love that shot as well. I think that's a really beautiful shot as well, the way it pans across and you can see all the different alleys, the different aisles with different things.
It really adds to that boringness and that idea that there's now this huge kitchen which is just operating for three people. I find all that stuff really kind of, it's sort of too big. Everything's too big.
Everything's
I like all that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah,
too big for them.
Did you see Dr. Sleep?
The problem with Dr. Sleep I've got is that I love the book so much, and then I heard it wasn't very good, and I get very angry about films when I love the books. I didn't watch it. Is it good? Is it good? Oh, good. I mean, I'm glad that I haven't missed out. Yeah,
it's a weird film. It's not got a very good bad guy, and it's sort of like, it would be, I don't know, if it didn't have anything to do with The Shining, It would feel like one of those lesser... What's that? Bag of Bones, starring Pierce Brosnan.
I haven't seen that.
It's a Stephen King adaptation from like the early to mid-2000s.
It feels
like that. It feels like if it didn't have Shiny... And then they do... The carpet turns up and they get Henry Thomas from E.T. to be Jack Nicholson. And then it's just like, hang on a minute. It's just this weird thing where it's not... Because Stephen King didn't like The Shining film and he didn't write a sequel to The Shining film, the film takes it upon itself to be the book, the sequel to the book, and the sequel to the film. I mean, it's like it's trying to do too many things.
Too much responsibility,
I think if it had just been an adaptation of the book, then and ignored the movie, The Shining movie, then it probably would have been able to be its own thing.
Yeah, I think what Kubrick was so good at is being really cocky and really like, you know, he wasn't trying to please Stephen King at all. So I think The Shining's just totally his film, really, isn't it? I don't know, have you read Pet Sematary?
No, I've not read it. I've seen both versions of it. Well, it's the sequel to the original.
Yeah, same. So Pet Sematary's one of my favourite books ever. Like, and I've always thought that storyline is just one of the creepiest, most brilliant storylines ever. The idea that you bury your dead child in a pet cemetery and it comes back to life. Like, it's just so sick. I love it so much. I watched is it the 80s version of the film the other day?
I think it was like, maybe it was 1990 or something like that. Yeah.
Oh my God, isn't it just hilarious? Like just it's brilliant. It's so shit. It's brilliant. And I really enjoyed it.
You've got like the flashback sequence with the sister that died. And that is absolutely horrifying.
Terrifying.
The makeup on it. Yeah, just absolutely horrifying. And then you've also got the Ramones song, and
which is great.
That is one of the best Ramones songs.
I don't want to be buried in a pet cemetery.
But what's interesting is they've used it on every version of the film, haven't they? And they also use it in Frankenweenie, the Tim Burton film. Yeah, it's like the soundtrack to all of them, I think. Yeah, it's a really odd film, that, because, as you say, it's like, it feels like a TV movie, except it has this flashback, which feels like it's from a completely different, much more terrifying film.
Yeah, I mean, I love it, but there are bits which are really funny, like when they've obviously got this actual child, and they're trying to get it to stab people, but they just have this fake plastic hand coming into shop, and somebody's clearly just holding this toddler while this plastic hand's coming out. It just made me laugh. It's daft.
That kid went on to be kind of like a superstar, didn't he? He was. Yeah. That was 1989. He was in Kindergarten Cop as the kid that says, "Girls have a vagina and boys have a penis." The other way around. And he was in Mercury Rising, which was the Bruce Willis movie that Bruce Willis made, where Bruce Willis teams up with a kid, and it was like one of the worst films ever made. And then the next year, Bruce Willis said, "I'm making another film with a kid," and everyone was like, "Whoa, don't do that." It was, and then it was The Sixth Sense, and you go, "Oh, good." It was very much like Keanu Reeves going, "Oh, I'm going to make another cyberpunk movie after Johnny." What are you doing? Oh, it's The Matrix. It's all right. It's fine. Yeah, so that kid went on and did loads of stuff. All right. What else have we got here? We've got...
Too many.
Don't Look Now?
Yeah, so I could put... Did I give you Don't Look Now and Rosemary's Baby? I didn't give you Rosemary's Baby.
You didn't put Rosemary's Baby.
All right. Okay. Oh, God,
You can talk about anything you want. We don't have to talk about this at all.
I'm insufferable with this stuff. Okay. Which one was it? Sorry?
Don't Look Now, but we can talk about it.
Don't Look Now. Okay, so have you seen Don't Look Now, guys?
Yeah, one of my favourites, all-time favourites.
I visited the writing desk of Daphne Du Maurier last 2 weeks ago and had a really nice time. Yeah, it was great.
Well, Don't Look Now, I'd say, I mean, it's another one that I watched when I was far too young and just stayed with me. So, like, just the energy and, like, the feeling of that film stayed with me forever. And I find it really inspiring just because just the music's amazing. I was listening to the soundtrack yesterday through some amazing speakers, and just like I find it so soothing, because it's, although it's obviously a really creepy film, I love that music. It's incredible. But yeah, the scenes that really stand out for me, I don't know if you've noticed, but on the DVD box they've got the reveal on the back, which is unforgivable.
Terrible.
Have you seen that?
No, I haven't noticed that. Who does the music? Is it Pino Donaggio, is it? Or is do I think that because it's a bit like those...
I was thinking Pino Donaggio, you know.
It is, yeah.
It's Pino Donaggio. Because he went on to do a lot of the Brian De Palma movies. And you can kind of feel like that's obviously a big influence on his movies. And I think my favourite thing about Don't Look Now is that it's all built up. Everything is built up to that last moment. Everything is so, like, it's almost like you're in a trap. That's what it feels like. You're watching this film, and it's, you're just on rail tracks that's going to take you to the ending, and there's no way out of it. You've got every choice to go, you can't get off it. It's all heading to that one bit.
And it feels like that in Venice anyway. I don't know if you've been, but it does feel like you're kind of trapped. And it's so beautifully put across in that film. And I think both their performances are amazing. I mean, talking about big acting, Donald Sutherland is also insanely over the top in that film, but it totally works. Like when
it's got my favourite bit. It's got my bit when he comes out of the toilet and he says to Julie Christie, I'd give it 5 minutes. And you go, you don't see that in movies.
You don't see that in movies. Yeah, there's a lot of their relationship is because they were actually a couple at that time. There's a lot of that in that film, which is just you totally buy it all. And they shag for real as well. I don't know if you knew that. That's a real shag they're doing there.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I've always heard that they say it isn't, but people feel like it is because it feels real.
Well, I think they claimed it was.
Okay.
But whether, I don't know. But yeah, I think that my favourite moments in that film, which I find really inspiring, are when he first looks at that picture from the church and the blood pours out into the church, and then he goes out and you see, I mean, there's something so iconic about that red outfit. You know, anyway, which is similar to that, like a Schindler's List kind of vibe, you know, where you just I'll never get that red outfit out of my head. But yeah, it's just a bloody good film.
So what year was Don't Look Now?
74.
So Nathaniel, what year was Obsession? Obsession was like 1980, was it?
No, I reckon it's before that. I reckon that's about 74, 75.
Because isn't Obsession set in Venice?
Is it? It might be, you know.
He meets an artist that is restoring some artwork in a church, and Obsession is a Brian De Palma film that feels very much like Don't Look Now as well.
I've never seen it. Would I like
it? Great. It's great. Obsession is great, but it's
76.
What is it? It's schlocky. It's kind of like very highly wrought. Schlocky. Yeah.
What's schlocky?
Schlocky. Schlock. It's like lots. It's sort of
hokey.
Like, broad, cheesy, but it's sort of like, in a way that Don't Look Now is kind of like, proper actors doing proper acting, whereas Obsession is, that take will do. It won't get in the way of the plot. Do you know what I mean? It's
kind of... Yeah. Oh, amazing. I'm going to check it out. I might watch it tonight, actually. Sure. But yeah, I think that Rosemary's Baby is similar. I know it's a bit daft, but I think that's a beautiful, horrible film as well. I've got Polish posters all over my flat of different, like, 70s horror films. It's like my thing. But I haven't got that on my list, so I won't talk about Rosemary's Baby.
You can talk about it. But Kyle Gass, who we had on a few weeks ago from Tenacious D, is a big fan of Rosemary's Baby.
Good lad.
And I have a bittersweet relationship with it because the love of my life, William Castle, produced it and wanted to direct it, and Roman Polanski took it away from him. And said, oh, I'm going to direct it, actually. It was the best choice because we probably wouldn't be talking about...
Yeah, we wouldn't be talking about Barry. It.
We wouldn't be talking about Rosemary's Baby if William Castle had directed it.
Mm. Also, Polanski, we're not really allowed to like him anymore anyway. But I can't... I just love that film. I love everything about the neighbours, the nosy neighbours that have a lot more to them than you think.
But that always feels like almost a companion piece to Don't Look Now.
Yeah,
that's like another one of those inevitable storylines where we're so late, we're nearly at the end. Oh fucking hell, I've completely lost track of time. Right, okay, well, Laura, we have to wind up really quickly, and then we got to play a game, right? So Giddy Stratospheres, it's available where?
In the UK, it's out now on Amazon, Sky, iTunes, Google something, Microsoft TV, which I didn't even know existed, but it's on there. Then in September, it's going to be released in the USA and worldwide, and we're going to be announcing where soon. And you can keep up to date with everything on all our social media stuff, which is just Giddy Stratospheres. It's easy to find us. We'll tell you everything there.
Great. We've got a minute and a half to play Better or Worse. Nathaniel, you need to race through it. You're in charge.
I hand you over.
It's fine.
The game is Better or Worse, and you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before, based on my opinions to score points.
Right.
Beginning with Scarlett Johansson. Is Sting better or worse than Scarlett Johansson, according to me?
Worse.
He is worse. Jimmy Nail, better or worse than Sting?
Worse.
Worse.
Better. Bill Murray, better or worse than Jimmy Nail?
Worse. Who knows?
Better. Bill Nighy, better or worse than Bill Murray?
Better.
No, worse. Worse. Kurt Russell, better or worse than Bill Nighy?
Better.
Danny
Am I
Dyer.
I'm supposed to be answering, are you, Nick? I don't know what the game is.
You're answering, Laura.
Stop overthinking it.
Danny Dyer, better or worse than Kurt Russell?
Better.
High cards.
Worse than Russell.
I love Dyer's
card. Sure, it could be a high card. Yeah. Danny Kurt DeVito, Russell. Better or worse than Danny Dyer?
Better.
Danny DeVito. Boyle, better or worse than Danny DeVito?
I've got it in for him at the moment. I'm going to say worse.
Danny Minogue, better or worse than Danny Boyle?
Better.
Worse. Kylie Minogue, better or worse than Danny Minogue?
Better.
Nick? Better.
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 So what's the score?
It's five.
Right, you got five, which means that you're not as good as Dane Baptiste and Marina Sirtis with 9, Baz from Massive Wreckage with 8, Jamie Adams, Carl Gass, Izzy City with 6, Sarah Gibbs. You're as good as Sarah Gibbs with 5. You're bang last. I'm sorry. It's a terrible result for you, Laura.
Good luck
with the film.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on.
You're welcome on the show anytime in the future if you've got anything to promote. Thank you for coming on. And
thank you for having me.
Don't go anywhere, but we're saying goodbye now. Goodbye from me. Goodbye from Nathaniel.
Goodbye.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Look after each other and see you next week. Bye.